funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the purpose of documentary filmmaking, and what impact do the best works have on the way we see the world and understand ourselves? In a career that spans more than four decades, Frederick Wiseman has directed more than three dozen documentaries covering subjects as diverse as military basic training, public housing and welfare, even the inner rhythms of Dallas's most famous retail store, Neiman Marcus. Titticut Follies, his harrowing, critically praised 1967 look at a Massachusetts hospital for the criminally insane, was banned for viewing by the general public until 1991. He's in town to speak about his ongoing work and his creative process tonight at SMU. We're delighted that he could make time for us this afternoon. Fred, welcome to Think.
Yes, thank you, Chris.
You began your professional career in law. Was there a point at which you decided that making films was a different kind of justice?
No. I started making films because I was teaching law, and I really didn't like that. And the little joke I make about law school is that I was physically present. And I reached the witching age of 30 and figured I better do something I liked rather than something that bored me. So I don't, from my point of view at least, the documentary films have nothing to do with having gone to law school. The value of having gone to law school for me is that it sometimes intimidates people in contract negotiations because they think I know more about the subject than I actually do.
I guess that couldn't hurt. What do you believe about objectivity in documentary filmmaking?
It's a non-issue. It doesn't exist. I mean, I don't see how anyone could say that documentary film or anything else is objective. I mean, because every aspect of documentary filmmaking involves choice. I mean, even if you're shooting with 360 cameras at 360 different angles, that represents as much of a choice as shooting with one camera and changing the angle. I substitute the word fair for the word objective. I say that my films are fair, and I work very hard to make them fair to the experience I had in making the film. Now, what does that mean in practice? If I'm editing a sequence, I don't change the order of events in the sequence, but I obviously have to summarize the sequence. So I may use, in a 50-minute sequence, I may use a minute. I mean, use the first minute, the 25th minute, the 32nd minute, and the 45th to the 47th minute. But I don't change the order, and I try to edit it when I compress it into a form that is fair to the original. But again, that's a subjective judgment. Somebody else may not think it's fair.
So where does the word truth fall into that formula?
I don't know. It's not a word that I use. The whole notion of cinema verite is a, you know, pompous French term. And I never use either the French term or the English translation. I make movies that are based on unstaged events. I don't think the camera changes people's behavior, I think anybody that says that his work is the truth is either a liar or pretentious or both.
So if you're doing your best to be fair, but you recognize that you can't avoid bias, is it your assumption that the audience will come away with a similar perspective to what you've come away with?
Well, it depends. I mean, bias is a loaded word.
Yeah.
I think my approach is novelistic in the sense that during the shooting, I'll accumulate about 100 hours of rushes. Then the final film is anywhere between the shortest is 73 minutes and the longest is 6 hours. Usually they run in two and a half hours. And I mean, it's the old cliche about the sculptor's cliche of finding the statue under the stone. I have to find the film under the 100 hours of rushes that I have. So that the film I discover the film in the course of the editing, and in as I say, I try to be fair in my choice of material, but my job is to create something that works as a movie, and since there is no narration no commentary of any sort other than what the people actually say, it's novelistic in the sense that the real film takes place where the mind of the viewer, the mind and eye and ears of the viewer, meet what's going on the screen, and it's left up to the viewer, as it is to the reader when they're reading a novel, to figure out what's going on. And one of my jobs as an editor is to present enough information so that the viewer can understand what's going on. But whenever you're dealing with unstaged events in film, you're dealing with ambiguity and you're dealing with complexity. And different people can have different ideas as to what, in fact, is going on. In the same way, when we meet somebody or we go to an event, you and I may have different interpretations as to what's happening. I try to provide the viewer with enough information so that my point of view toward the material is clear, but also there's enough room left so that they clearly can disagree with me about the interpretation.
Well, we definitely have this sense, I think, watching your films, that we've been dropped in the middle of something.
Well, that's good, because yeah. I want you to feel as if you were there.
Mm-hmm. Does it ever mean that you cannot show a specific scene because you realize that in service to fairness, people won't fully understand or they won't have enough perspective based on what you were able to collect while you were following things?
Well, I mean, that could happen, and I hope it hasn't happened, but I work very hard to prevent it from happening. It doesn't mean that I've always succeeded, but I'm very aware of that as a problem, and I always do the best I can to provide enough information so that someone can understand what's going on. I mean, the most extreme example of that, of the ambiguity that I was talking about is the second film I made was about a high school in Philadelphia. And it was about a big urban high school, and I think there were 12 black students and 4,000 white students, and this was 1968. And the film is kind of, in many ways, kind of a sad comedy. I think it's fair to say the film raises a lot of questions about the nature of the education the students are getting in that school. But when there was a woman named Louise Day Hicks, who was head of the Boston School Committee at the time, and she was extremely conservative. And a friend of mine brought her to see the film. And when I knew she was coming, I thought she'd hate the film. And I met her afterwards, and she said to me, "Oh, Mr. Wiseman, that was a wonderful film. Can you tell me how we can get schools like that in Boston?" And I didn't think that was a failure on my part in the film. It's just that she was on the other side of all the issues. And she clearly felt there was enough information in the film to support her preconceived view as to what a high school should be.
You mentioned that you don't think people can perform for the camera. So many people would say that's impossible, that everybody with a camera in the room is acting in a more exaggerated way or perhaps a more refined way than they normally would.
Well, there's no, you know, clear proof of it one way or the other. I think whether you're a filmmaker or an interviewer for radio or television or a journalist or an insurance salesman or a teacher or a lawyer or a doctor, anybody that meets a lot of people all the time has to, for survival purposes, has to be very aware of when they're being conned or when somebody's telling them a story that isn't true about their lives. So similarly, when you're making one of these movies, if you think that somebody's acting or saying something they wouldn't ordinarily say in the circumstance, you stop shooting. Or if you don't realize it till you get to the editing room, I don't use the sequence. But my experience is if people don't want to be photographed, they say no, or they walk away, they thumb their nose, or they make it clear that they don't want to be photographed. I don't think most of us are not good enough actors to put on a new performance. If we were, then the level of acting in Hollywood movies and in the theater would be much better than it is, because there'd be a wider range of actors to choose from. I think if people are made nervous by the presence of the camera, they act in ways that they think are appropriate for the situation that they're in. And that's precisely what you want as a documentarist. I give you another extreme example. I made a film about the Kansas City Police in 1968. And in Kansas City at the time, in order to make an arrest for prostitution, the undercover cop had to have a price and an act. So in this case, the undercover cop solicited a woman, brought her back to a hotel. The need for a price and an act meant practically the policeman had to get into bed with her before, presumably at the last minute, he made the arrest. That happened in this case, and he was leading her down the stairs of the hotel after he'd arrested her, and she knocked him down the stairs and fled. He called the vice squad car. We were in the vice squad car. We responded to the call. When we came to the hotel where they, where the couple had gone, the bellboy said that the woman had fled to the basement. The vice squad and the undercover policeman went down to the basement, and there was no light in the basement. It was, by chance, I had an artificial light with me that night. And they found the woman under a pile of furniture, hiding under a pile of furniture. They dragged her out, and one of the policemen started to strangle her in front of the camera. And he let her go after 15 or 20 seconds. But, you know, he was clearly strangling her. You could hear her gurgle. And then he let her go, and the woman said to one of the other policemen there, he was trying to strangle me. And the other policeman said, oh, no, you were just imagining that. And yet, you know, there it is on film and on tape. Now, I don't think that policeman strangled or started to strangle that woman because he was acting for the camera, nor do I think he would have killed her if we weren't there, if we hadn't been there. I think he thought that what he was doing was an appropriate thing to do to a prostitute who had knocked a policeman down and resisted arrest. And that's only an extreme example of my answer to your question. I think all of us do act in ways that we think are appropriate, but may not – other people in viewing those acts of ours may not share our view as to their appropriateness. And it's because we all think we're reasonable people doing decent things, et cetera, et cetera. And I also don't want to give a bad impression of the Kansas City Police Department, because the film shows lots of kind and generous and helpful things the police were doing. But I take that as an example of the camera not affecting behavior. That's an extreme example.
Documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman is my guest. He's in town to lecture tonight at SMU from 6:30 to 8:30 in the Theater of the Hughes Trigg Student Center. You can find information at smu.edu or on the Think page of kera.org. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is documentarian Frederick Wiseman. He will lecture this evening at SMU. You can find information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So much of your work, Fred, takes us into places where, today we can't imagine that people would want a camera to be. I wonder to what extent you think that your gift for getting this work done is based on your ability to sort of talk your way into a situation and get permission to be there.
Well, I mean, you certainly have to get permission. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as talking my way in because I'm always extremely straightforward when I request permission because I think if I not telling a straight story, that can, come to haunt me. So there's a practical reason as well as an ethical reason for always being very straightforward. So that what I do is simply make a request, and I describe how the film's going to be made, the period of time it will take, the method of shooting it, the method of editing it, that I have editorial control, that it'll be shown to some extent theatrically and widely on television, public television in the United States and other television channels in other countries. So, and either people say yes or no. I mean, I don't make any effort to talk people into it because if there's any reluctance, I don't really want to do it. They have to, think it's a good idea. Fortunately, most of the time, people like the idea. And because I've been very rarely, the only time I've ever really been turned down was, and that was, I started to do the film that became Law and Order, the one that I described a moment ago, in Los Angeles. And then after a week shooting in Los Angeles, I was told I could do anything I wanted except to ride around on the police cars. And since there were no foot patrols, that basically killed the story. But that's the only experience I had of being turned down. Every other place, it's been relatively easy to get permission. It took, with the exception of the film that became Titicut Follies, it took me a year and a half, that was my first film, it took me a year and a half to get permission for that. And when I did a movie in France about the French theater company, the Comédie Française, I had to get the permission of 23 unions. So I spent 3 months going to the committee every day, just meeting the union members, and they ultimately voted to give me permission. But again, that was their decision. I think the worst thing you can do in this kind of filmmaking is try and con people or give them a phony story because it's ethically not correct, and it'll come back to haunt you.
Do you think the reaction to Titicut Follies and the banning and everything else sort of solidified for you the kinds of stories that you would take on in your career?
No, not at all. Because, I've been trying to make movies about as many different aspects of American life as I can. The prison where I made Titicut Follies, which is a Massachusetts correctional institution at Bridgewater, which is a maximum security prison, was a pretty horrible place. But compared to other prisons for the criminally insane that existed in America at that time, it was the Ritz Hotel. For example, if you compared it to the prison for the criminally insane in Mississippi in 1968, the analogy to the Ritz would have been clear. It was one of the best of its kind, as bad as it was. I think it's just as important in documentary film to show people being helpful and doing good things as it is to show them doing unpleasant and horrible things. I mean, and even that's even true of the Follies, because the guards at Bridgewater, in their own rough and ready way, were much more tuned in to the needs of the inmates than the so-called helping professionals, the psychiatrists and the social workers.
Yeah, it becomes really clear they know them by name, and they have an odd kind of almost affection for the patient.
Yeah, and camaraderie, because basically they're locked up with them 8 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week. So they spend a lot of time with them, and they know them. The lead guard in that film, Eddie, I mean, he was much nicer to the inmates and much treated them as fellow human beings, much more than the psychiatrist did, who in their effort to pin labels like schizophrenic or manic depressive or whatever, were thinking of the inmates as objects. The guards, by and large, didn't feel that way. So that even in the Follies, that complexity is present. And a couple of years after Follies, I made a film about the emergency ward of Metropolitan Hospital in New York. And I had great admiration and respect for the doctors and nurses who were working in a situation where they had 600,000 clinic cases a year. I mean, it was a volume business. And they were kind, by and large, kind and patient and understanding and helpful toward the sick people that came through. So that I'm interested in showing in the films as many different aspects of human behavior as I can. I'm not interested in, nor do I think I make, expose movies.
So you shoot for 8 or 10 weeks, and then you go back and begin the editing process. I wonder if you can talk about any perspective you've gained on the vagaries of human memory and what may be solidified in your mind, and then suddenly you're looking at a piece of film and a quote isn't exactly what you thought it was, or a moment looks different than you recall.
Of course. I mean, that's a very valid comment in your question, because that happens all the time. And one of the luxuries of working in this form is you have the opportunity in the editing to go over it. I mean, I've been doing this for 40 years now, I'm at an age when I can't remember my own name sometimes, but I can remember all the dialogue and all the rushes and all the movies because I've looked at it so often. I'm constantly checking out my memory of an event against what I have in the rushes. And, of course, sometimes you forget. The editing gives me an opportunity to think through my own relationship both to the original experience of being at the place for 8 or 10 weeks and also the experience of having the opportunity to study the material in whatever depth I want, because what I have to do in the editing is identify to myself what is happening on the screen in front of me. And because unless I feel that I understand what's happening in a given sequence, I won't know how to use it. I won't know how to edit it as a sequence originally, and then I wouldn't know how to place it in relationship to other sequences. So that making one of these movies is, in a sense, an intense experience in observation and in trying to attach some kind of meaning to what it is you're seeing and hearing.
Do those two things remain discrete in your mind, your personal recollection and then what it is you've put together in the finished film, or by that process do the two things merge?
Well, it's by that process because, I mean, I may, you know, remember a sequence by a shorthand way. I may refer to a man and a woman in a sequence in Welfare as the happy couple. But that's my shorthand way of recalling the experience. But I may refer to them as the happy couple in my notes. And, you know, I think I'll use the sequence with the happy couple here. When I edit, I don't edit in the abstract, in the sense I don't edit in my head. I may have an idea, but I have to try it out physically. I have to cut the sequence to conform to the idea, and usually in the course of cutting the sequence, it changes the original idea, gets modified in some way or another. I have to have the practical experience of seeing how the shots fit together. I can't do it in the abstract.
So what you do is you cut the sequences first as individual things, and then you assemble them all into a
right.
structured film?
The editing process, when I come back from the shooting, I look at all the rushes, and I sort of evaluate what I have. Not sort of, I evaluate what I have. And then I make a list of the sequences that I might want to use in the final film. And then I edit all those sequences into a usable form. And that usually takes me 6 or 8 months. And then at the end of that period, and only then do I start to assemble the structure. And I can do that relatively quickly because at that point I know the material very well and I can make the changes very quickly. And all the sequences are, if not finally edited, close to finally edited, close to their final form. So then it takes me only 3 or 4 days to get the first assembly of the film, which usually runs 30 or 40 minutes longer than the final film. And then I work on the rhythm internally within a sequence and then the rhythm between the sequences. By that, for example, I try, and that's the dramatic structure is one of the ways this kind of filmmaking represents writing, or is similar to writing a play or a novel, because I have to be I'm making a movie, and I have to be concerned about the structure, and I have to be concerned about the dramatic structure, and I have to be concerned about all the typical construction problems that you have in a play or a novel, making issues of characterization, issues of passage of time, issues of foreshadowing. Not having two major dramatic sequences butt up each other against each other after a very dramatic sequence, having a moment of silence so that the audience can sort of put together their thoughts and so that the effect of the sequence isn't lost by immediately going to something else that's equally or more dramatic. So those are all the kinds of things that I have to juggle.
What do you think about the narrative remake of the Maisel's film Grey Garden that's about to come out?
Not having seen it, it's hard to have an opinion, but I...
Just as an idea, what do you think?
I would approach it with some degree of skepticism, mm-hmm. Because I think it would be very hard to match the original.
You work with a pretty small crew typically when you're out shooting, is that right?
Right, mm-hmm. Three of us.
And you like to work with the same people if you can?
Yes, because you work, you have to work very fast, and you have to be able to understand each other with a gesture, blink of the eye, quick pointing with your hand, starting run after something. I mean, you have to know each other well, and you. Have to move quickly, and you have to stay out of each other's way. So that it's nice to work. And I've worked with a lot of the same people for years.
Are they with you ever during the editing process?
No. I have an assistant who synchronizes the rushes for me, and then I edit alone.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, it really does become your memory as opposed to other people who were also capturing the same sequences.
I don't even show the movie to anybody until it's finished.
Do you keep all the footage that didn't make it into finished films?
I do. Until recently, I had 6 million. The negative, the original negative, both of the final cut film and the rushes, was always kept in a vault. But the work print, which is the copy I use when I edit, I had 6 million feet of rushes in the basement of my house until a couple of years ago when I put them on deposit at the Library of Congress. And I moved also all the original negatives, both of the rushes and of the edited film, to the Library of Congress.
What do you think is the value of preserving that and hanging on to it, even if it won't necessarily ever be publicly shown?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. In fact, I often thought about destroying it. Because I don't particularly like the idea of 50 or 100 years from now somebody picking through it when the copyright's expired and trying to make another film out of it. Obviously, I want to preserve the negatives of the cut films, but at the moment I haven't destroyed them. The argument I've made for destroying them. The argument for not destroying it is that they represent perhaps, theoretically at least, valuable material for historians of our time 100 years from now. Historians of other centuries, assuming that people continue to exist, will be even more confused than historians from, say, the 18th century, because in addition to having all the print material available, they have all this photographic material available. I often wondered, what it would have been great to have movies about the Civil War, or what a hospital looked like in 1850, or what the police did in New York City in 1810. People in succeeding generations will have that available if they care to look at it, not only from my films, but from, hundreds of other films that were made.
And you shoot exclusively on film, right? No video?
Yes, exclusively on film, although I may, try something on high definition sometime. I'll probably do that at a point when I can't get the money to shoot on film, because it is more expensive to shoot on film. But film looks better. There's no question about that.
And do you do all of – is it only linear editing, or have you switched to digital editing?
Well, I just finished a film on the ballet company at the Paris Opera, and I edited that on an Avid, which is digital editing, because financial reasons. It was shot on film, but the editing was on the Avid. And I like some aspects of that. I disliked other aspects. I like the idea of working on an editing table and handling the film, at the risk of sounding pretentious. There's something artisanal about that, which I like, or maybe just because I've been doing it for 40 years.
Frederick Wiseman is my guest. He's a documentarian who has made more than 36 films. He will be lecturing this evening at SMU at 6:30. You can find information about that appearance at smu.edu. You can also send email to think@kera.org if you'd like to join the conversation. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is documentarian Frederick Wiseman, who is in town to lecture this evening at SMU. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. What is your feeling for when it's appropriate to use black and white to tell a story, and when you like to use color?
Well, generally speaking, I like black and white. But the first film I did in color was the film about the Neiman Marcus main store in Dallas, because I thought it was important to show what the goods looked like, the colors of the good. That's part of the story, the products that they were selling. It reached the point where the technical developments on color film made it possible to shoot in much lower light circumstances than in black and white, because black people stopped using black and white, and Kodak didn't do as much experimentation, and the black and white stock remained the same, while the color stock got much faster. So I continued to shoot in color, but given the choice, I prefer black and white. But then again, some of the subjects that I subsequently did demanded color, the way the Neiman Marcus film did. For example, in 1983 or 4, I did 4 movies about the Alabama Institute for the Deaf and Blind. And color became a subject of the film because color was absent, or by and large absent, from the life of the blind students. So it was important for the film to show the color of the natural world because it was absent from their lives. And since I did the Neiman Marcus film, I've only done one film in black and white, and that was a film called Near Death, which was shot in the medical intensive care unit of a hospital, Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, and is about how decisions are made to stop treating dying people. And again, I like the black and white because it's more abstract and it's more subtle.
There's a scene in Titicut Follies that the people who've seen the film will undoubtedly remember, where the inmate Jim has been shaved and he's bleeding. And the black and white seems to work so much better there, even than the vivid red blood, because it's just this sort of black smear on his face. And I can't imagine seeing that in color.
No, I mean, for the same reason I didn't, the blood issue was one of the reasons I didn't do Near Death in color. But I mean, just in terms of the image, the black and white is often more elegant looking.
Did the Neiman Marcus film feel like a foil to you personally, to some of the other works that you've done on, you know, things like welfare and public housing?
Not a foil, but as I said before, I try to do movies about as many different aspects of American life as I can. And certainly The Store, which is the film about Neiman Marcus, and welfare are two opposite ends of American life. One of the reasons I wanted to do Neiman Marcus is because it gave me access to a different class than the people who were at the welfare center. The same thing was true of Racetrack, which I did at the Belmont Racetrack just outside of New York. Because a lot of my movies are concerned with class, either with all number of classes or one class or another. I mean, Aspen, the movie I did about Aspen, Colorado, was about rich upper-class people. Some movies combine all elements of class. Racetrack combines all elements. Class elements in American life are represented in that movie, as is the movie I did about a small town in Maine, Belfast, Maine. So it's true that welfare and The Store would make an interesting double bill, because they're two poles of American life.
How much do you try to know about a subject before you go in on the first day of filming?
Well, I usually don't do much research. I usually only spend a day or two at the place in advance to get a sense of the geography and what the routine is. I don't like to be around observing, so-called, or doing research, because I like to be able to shoot what I find. And at least if I'm not there, I don't know what I missed.
As opposed to thinking, I should have had my camera.
Yeah. And in a sense, the shooting of the film is the research. Because since I don't repeat any events, if I spent 3 months in a place and then I came back to shoot the film, I might know some of the people better. But the events, well, there might be some similar events. There wouldn't be the same events. So for good or bad, I don't do any research. The only time I spent any length of time at a place before the shooting started was again at the Comédie Française, because I had to get the consent of the unions.
How do characters start to emerge for you over the course of filming?
Well, basically as you meet them. Mm-hmm. But since I don't, none of the films is about one person, they're not as individually character driven as other documentaries are that follow one or two people. But I mean, you know when someone has good value right away. I mean, because either they're funny, or they have an interesting face, or they sing, or they have an important position at the place. I did a movie about a monastery, an Anglican Benedictine monastery, and the abbot was the central figure at the monastery. So he's in the film a lot. And similarly, the movie of the Comédie Française, the administrator of the Comédie Française held most of the power. So he's in the movie a lot because it would be misrepresentation if he weren't, because he was the key person in making the decisions about what plays were going to be presented and the choice of actors and, you know, all the daily aspects of the theater.
Is there any back and forth discussion between you and your subjects during the filming, or do you try to be entirely invisible?
Oh, there's a lot of back and forth discussion because most of the time you're at a place, you're not shooting. You're hanging around. And I use that time to familiarize myself with what's happening and with the people. And people are curious, and they come by and, you know, they want to know what you're doing, and I explain how the camera and the tape recorder work, and so he's interested in hearing how the sound's recorded. I put the earphones on their head, or you put the camera on the person's shoulder, and they look through the viewfinder. But often the people at the place know, particularly the people who work there, know a lot more about the place than I do. So I am both dependent on and I encourage people to be informants in the best sense of the word. And when they come up and make suggestions, I always make little notes. For example, the high school movie I made in Philadelphia in 68, the first day I was at the school, a man came up to me and introduced himself as the dean of discipline, which already is an interesting
job
description. And he said, you ought to come to my office at 9:15 in the morning. You'll see all the culprits lined up outside the door. So the next morning I went down to his office, and it became difficult to stay away from his office because in disciplining the students for locking a teacher in the closet or throwing chalk at each other or beating each other up or whatever they were doing, he felt compelled to tell them what values of the school they were breaking. And that those sequences became very important for the film because it's one of the most difficult things to get in this kind of filmmaking is people standing back and expressing what they think the values of the place are. And it also became useful because often what went on in those encounters was quite funny. But I was led to it by the dean of discipline because he came up and said, come to my office. And that kind of experience is very common. And I go out of my way to talk to people when we're not shooting. So that's one of the ways I do my research during the shooting.
You don't, though, as I understand it, sit people down in front of a camera and have them talk to the camera.
No, I've never done that.
Yeah.
There are no interviews.
Is it less interesting to you, or do you just think it's not as revealing as just watching people behave?
Well, I don't think it's as – I mean, I think it's revealing in a different way. A really good interviewer can elicit all kinds of startling and interesting and original information. I mean, one of the documentary filmmakers I admire the most is Marcel Ophuls, who made some great movies about The Sorrow and the Pity, which is about the French collaborated with the Germans during the war, or Hotel Terminus, which is about Klaus Barbie, the German officer who was responsible for killings of lots of Jews and French during the war. And Marcel's in the movie, and he's interviewing people, and they're fascinating movies, because his questions are so good and he finds such interesting people to ask the questions to. So I don't suggest that my way of making movies is the only way or the only way you can get information. It's a way. It just happens to be the way that I like to work.
I'm curious about the kinds of things that younger filmmakers who have the chance to talk to you want to interact about.
Well, actually, I don't talk to that many young filmmakers. The theory is, the idea is that the so-called digital revolution is going to make, there'll be a lot more good movies. I'm not so sure, and this may be an old fuddy-duddy's view, but I think one consequence of for sure of the digital revolution is that more bad movies will be made because too many people think it's easy. You just take the camera and point it and you got a movie. And it's a lot of work. And it's work that requires, if you're going to have half a chance of succeeding, making all kinds of judgments which you hope are discriminating judgments about what to shoot and how to shoot it and how to use it in the editing. And one of the things that's interesting for me about making documentary movies is that it makes demands on all aspects of my being, emotional, intellectual, and physical.
Has the willingness of PBS changed over the years to put anything that you create on the air?
No, PBS has always been extremely generous with me and very supportive. I wouldn't have been able to make all these movies without PBS's support. They don't give me all the money for the movie, but they usually give me enough money to get started, and then I have to find the rest. But, I mean, and they've always broadcast them in prime time, and they've always broadcast them at the odd lengths that I've given them, which I, you know, I'm very grateful for.
Are there any of your films that you think are vastly better shown on a large screen before an audience than they play on TV?
I think every movie is better on a large screen. Certainly, I much prefer to see my movies on a large screen, and I try to get them shown in theaters. But they are to some extent. But I'm still very pleased that PBS runs them because they reach a much larger audience that way than they do in theaters.
How far out are you lining up topics and subjects for the films that you plan to do?
Well, usually by the time within a couple of months of finishing a movie, I get a bit nudgy and start thinking about the next one. Because it takes a while both to get permission and to get the money.
Is a year always the right amount of time to sort of get it all done between the shooting and the editing?
It's usually, the cycle is usually about a year. It takes me about a year.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning of shooting, or from the from the idea to the end of the editing.
Do you see any relationship whatsoever between what you do as a documentarian and the reality TV that's out there today?
Well, I don't really know because I've only watched so-called reality TV for a couple of minutes and I've turned it off because it seemed to me the little bit that I watched and really is 2 or 3 minutes. And what I read about it seems to me phony because so much of it is staged and people are in not artificial situations. I guess some of it isn't this following going on, but it doesn't – I don't think it makes it real to put people who don't know each other on an island together or in a house together and see what happens. Somebody said to me once that I was the godfather of reality TV, I certainly hope that's not the case because that would not be anything I would want to take credit for.
Frederick Wiseman is a documentarian. He's made over 36 films during his career. He will lecture tonight at 6:30 at SMU. The admission is free, and you can find information at smu.edu. Fred, it's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My name is
it.
Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.